WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. U.S. Marine veteran Trevor Reed, held by Russia for 3 years before being brought out in a prisoner swap, has been injured fighting against Russian forces in Ukraine. CBS's Weijia Zhang says, according to the Biden administration, it did not know Reed had gone to Ukraine.
And this was a decision that he made on his own to go and support Ukraine. And number two, that the U.S. government has been explicitly warning against this, warning against Americans going to Ukraine on their own.
Bo Bergdahl's sentence is thrown out by a federal judge. CBS's Matt Piper has the latest.
A judge has wiped the conviction and sentence for Bo Bergdahl. He's the former Army sergeant who deserted his post in Afghanistan in 2009 and was captured by the Taliban. In a revelation made in the Serial podcast in 2015, he said he did it to call attention to problems at his unit and wound up never facing prison time.
To the lives of the men in that company.
Now, the federal judge says the Army colonel who oversaw that trial had applied for a job with the Trump-era Department of Justice, raising the appearance of bias. Then President Trump called Bergdahl a traitor and suggested that he be executed. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Some portions of the U.S. are again dealing with smoke from Canadian wildfires. WCCO-TV reporter Jonah Kaplan is at the Wildfire Command Center in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
Nearly 29 million acres burned. That's like the entire state of Iowa on fire. All of it's being monitored right here at what's called CIFC, the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center. There are 12 countries that are contributing to the firefighting effort. Everything is done on the provincial level, whether it's in British Columbia, the Northwest Territories, all the way east to Quebec, even in Newfoundland, Prince Edward Island, and Nova Scotia.
Looks like package delivery will be uninterrupted at UPS now that the company and Teamsters have reached a tentative contract deal. Indiana businessman Bob Schruck had come up with an alternate plan just in case.
I just changed two vendors to FedEx. So when I receive packages now, I'm stopping all my UPS packages on the inward bound. Not because I don't like UPS, but it's just I can't afford for them not to deliver.
The 340,000 employees still have to approve the deal. President Biden is proposing a rule he hopes will persuade insurance companies to increase their coverage for mental health treatments. It would require insurance companies to study whether their customers have equal access to medical and mental health benefits and provide the same level of coverage for both.
Our networks of providers are badly inadequate, with far fewer psychiatrists, therapists, and other mental health professionals compared to all other medical specialties.
This is CBS News.
Need to hire quality candidates fast? You need Indeed, the end-to-end hiring solution. Attract, interview, and hire candidates all in one place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. Racist threats and vandalism will have a West Dallas man behind bars for a couple of years. The U.S. Attorney's Office and the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division worked together on the case against 45-year-old William McDonald. McDonald vandalized vehicles and property, left threatening notes filled with racial slurs, and demanded that the victims leave the neighborhood. Just before it was going to expire, the air quality advisory was extended. Waukesha, Racine, Milwaukee, and Kenosha counties are included in the extension that now runs through 11 tonight. During the Waukesha County Fair, 252 people were asked about their Republican presidential preference. Two of them expressed support for Mike Pence. The informal poll conducted by the County Republican Party had former President Donald Trump winning the vote with Ron DeSantis in second. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Attention, Wisconsin veterans.
Hello, I'm Tony Evers, the governor of Wisconsin. If you are a veteran struggling to pay for rent, utilities, or other life-sustaining services, I want you to know that the Veterans Rental Assistance Program is here to help. You have already made a most noble sacrifice. You shouldn't have to continue doing so. We are here to support you. The Veterans Rental Assistance Program was created by and for people living in Wisconsin, with benefit approvals being issued to veterans in just days, not months. It's never easy to ask for assistance, but rest assured, we're here to help. You've always been there for us. We want you to know that we're here for you. Call 833-WISVRAP. That's 833-947-8727, or visit VRAPWI.com. On behalf of the state of Wisconsin, thank you.
This summer, 540 AM WAUK has a new lineup.
Yes, that's awesome.
Starting at 6 AM, Up North News, 8 to 10, The Earl Ingram Show. Mondays, 8 to 9, Under the Helmet with the Grave Digger, Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram. 10 to 12, As Goes Wisconsin. At noon, Civic Media Network News. At 12:15, Town Call. 1 to 3, The Todd Alba Show. 3 to 4, Matt Flynn Direct. 4 to 6, The Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crute. And 6 to 7, The Maggie Dawn Show. On 540 AM. WAUK.
CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Netroots Nation. Chicago. I got to tell you, I still love Chicago. The food, amazing. Saw a Cubs game, outstanding. 8 home runs in an 8-3 game. When do you see something like that? But I'm sitting here with, and I got to tell you, one of the things I love characters. And one of the folks I've came across, Matthew Mudcat Arnold. He's the managing partner of Corsair Campaigns. They do digital, they do radio, TV ads. They're the guys who do the stuff that you see and read all over the place. But Mudcat, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, I appreciate you having me.
So I gotta know the Mudcat. What?
All right. So
your parents didn't name you Mudcat, did they?
No, they were not so cruel. But I'll tell you the story. So in 2006, I'd go do my first federal race in Rhode Island for Senator Whitehouse's first campaign, and I've got a buddy, Jake. Jake and I meet. He says he's from Long Island, or says he's from New Jersey. Jake says he's from New Jersey, and as we get to know each other, he grew up on Long Island. His parents owned a business on Long Island. He had moved to Jersey City and gotten an apartment while he was going to NYU. I'm like, Jake, you are not from New Jersey. You're from Long Island. Where you go to high school is where you're from. And he says, no, I am in Rhode Island. I got here from New Jersey. I'm from New Jersey. Dude, that is not how it works. And if you're going to pick a place, if you're going to make stuff up, why would you pick a place like New Jersey?
And I knew that's where we were going.
And he says, I am not going to take that from about where I'm from a dude from Mississippi. And this is back in the day when the first thing in a Google result was the image results. And he Googles my hometown, and the first thing that popped up was the logo of the Mississippi Mudcats. Minor league baseball team. And then I had to stand up in the campaign office, you know, for the Sheldon Whitehouse campaign, you know, full of the, you know, alumni societies of Harvard, Jaylen Brown, and explain in this accent what a mudcat was, what noodling was. And it was not a thing.
That's not a thing.
Like one time, like the printer broke, and somebody said, oh, Mudcat. But the next campaign I went to, because I've been a campaign kid forever, like I bounced around race to race, longer than anybody should have done that. But the next campaign I go to is a governor's race in Kentucky, and a bunch of the Rhode Island kids were there. I get introduced on the phone call, and out of the back, one of the dudes from Rhode Island says, And in Rhode Island, we called him Mudcat. And the Kentucky dudes lost their minds. It's the Mississippi Mudcat. And it's been my first name ever since.
There you go. No, that is a great story.
Thanks.
I was thinking of something worse, but that's a good story.
But you know, we're in the storytelling business, yeah, right? Like, as ad makers, as political consultants, we have to think about, you know, what is a good act structure, right? And that story's got two, right? You've got your time in Rhode Island. You've got your time in Kentucky.
And then you've got that moment.
Yeah. So a little bit of the, you know, thought process that goes into our work ends up in my own origin story.
No, that is fantastic. And now you've been doing this quite a while. And look, you know, the ad move, that this has been, you know, it used to be in the old days, ads were, you know, 30 seconds long. Now we get, what, 5, 6 seconds, 10 seconds to get someone's attention?
There's so much more inventory. We're selling so much more stuff in so many more places. So, we have six-second ads. We run them, you know, all the time. And it is hard to have basically anything other than a shout in 6 seconds, right? And we do them a lot for GOTV. Go vote! There was one that I did a couple of cycles ago that was literally just 6 seconds of different people saying, vote, vote, go vote, go vote, 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 right? That was the six-second spot. But I've also done some in the six-second format that were interesting. There was a lieutenant governor campaign in Mississippi where we did a series of them, and I think the best one was just like him driving an RV, and he says, you know, you can't be governor of Mississippi, Justin Jackson. You got to go more places than Johnny Cash. And we did that in 6 seconds.
That's creative.
Thanks.
It speaks to an audience.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's really what you're doing. You're packaging this candidate for various audiences.
Yep. And then, you know, we do stuff that goes out to 2 minutes, 3 minutes. We're doing some stuff right now for League of Conservation Voters around Georgia farms, helping farmers and the conservation movement advocate for the farm bill. And we've got stuff that's going in 30-second formats, 60-second formats. There'll be 2 minutes of farmers who are, you know, real farmers running real operations in South Georgia, right? Like, we're not talking about, oh, we went to Georgia, meaning we went to Atlanta. No, sir, we were in Coffee County and Irwin County. We landed in Savannah and then drove another 2 hours. I didn't know you could still be in Georgia 2 hours outside of Savannah. But we did that work, and it's farmers talking about the challenges that they're facing from climate change, right? They talk about watermelons. Watermelons used to be ripe on the 4th of July, and you would get red, ripe, sweet watermelons. Now they're coming in May and June, and it's because literally the weather's changed. But it's drier, so the fruit is different.
Right.
They are selling a different product.
So from the left perspective, from a Democratic perspective, because farmers are supposed to be all right wing and all, you know, all crazy conservative, you know, this should be a nonpartisan kind of issue that environmentalists are able to grab these people and move them politically in a direction. No.
Yeah, we would hope. You know, the truth is reality has a liberal bent. And climate change is one of those things that it is happening to everybody equally. We
right.
would expect that right-wingers, folks whose businesses are affected, whose families are affected, who are seeing, you know, everything from extreme weather to extended forest fires, that they would be sympathetic to doing something. But that has not been what we've seen, you know, in Congress.
No, I mean, when you talk about the stories that you tell and that I think it's important that you do this. Now, what's interesting to me is, you know, I've seen this frame that's out there. It's, you know, we're no longer looking at 30-second ads as, you know, just marketing and all that. It's now micro learning. Have you heard this phrase, micro learning? We're learning in 30-second increments, in little tidbits.
So
do you do micro learning?
This is not a concept I am familiar with at all. The first time that I've ever heard this word is when you just said it, but I am a politician, so I will riff on the idea.
Yes, please, sir. Do.
I don't have to know about it to talk about it. What kind of ad man would I be if I needed to be informed?
Now you could sell a ketchup popsicle to a woman wearing white gloves in the winter.
Working on it, baby. So attention spans are shorter. People are consuming more content. They're consuming more content in more places, right? We have Facebook, we have Instagram. That's last generation stuff. We've now got folks who are using Twitch, who are using Discord, who are thinking about media really that they opt into. And that has been something that we've been happy to expand. We want to meet people where we are. That is the first rule of organizing, right? Bob Kramer sent me to talk to you, and Bob Kramer, when I was 22 years old, told me that the most important thing an organizer can do is to meet people where they are.
Right.
And I have kept the faith in that way. So when people, if you are opting in to spend your time on Twitch and to have a conversation, and because those are conversational spaces, right? People are having feedback. We want to be able to reach you. We want to be able to advance our goals and our values. So, yeah, we work with influencers to develop that kind of content. We put stuff on Snapchat. We believe that if you build a big enough net, you can talk to everybody, right? So we are talking, we are buying, you know, demographic stuff, media consumption based on what you're Googling, the stuff that you're commenting on online. We are buying stuff geographically based on where we are, in an effort to make sure that everybody who has a device sees an ad. So we want to maximize the reach for our clients. And that's kind of how we start to think about that.
But also, ultimately, the candidate's message.
Yes.
And the candidate still has to have a message.
Yes.
At least I hope. I mean, there still has to be something that you're going to do to make people's lives better.
So the way we come at that, every candidate goes through an onboarding process, and we develop a messaging triangle, and every other media consultant develops a messaging triangle. It ain't special. The belief that we bring to that is that if you answer three questions, every voter wants to know the answer to three questions. Who are you? Who are you for? And what are you going to do? And so through the process of message development and refining with a candidate, we take their good ideas and help them put their best foot forward and get it into that 30-second soundbite, you know, that sort of six-word response.
That's the art, isn't it? And that's why a candidate would come to you.
Yes. The best conversation starts with, I believe in my community. I think there are these things that we can do. I need help. How do I explain to people that we have these things, and if we do things this way, things will be better, right? Because then we get to do that exercise, and, you know, it's just a lot of drafting and getting to know somebody and getting to understand the emotionally resonant part of their own argument.
See, now what you're talking about is all the positive stuff that I think people say they want in campaigns.
Yeah.
Now what we actually get is all the negative stuff.
Rick, you would be shocked at how effective it is. We can spend hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars building brand ID, building a concept in the minds of voters of a candidate, and then somebody comes along behind you and spends $150,000, you know, 15, 20% of what you've spent building your positive on a negative. If it is emotionally resonant, if it is true, if it disqualifies a candidate to a voter, I have seen 30 points come off a candidate.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is the thing. We all say
it really works.
We all say we want positive campaigns. We all say we want, what are we going to do? You know, show us your best. But it all comes down to the mud, Mudcat.
Yeah. And, you know, every political consultant loves to make negative ads. Because the best job I ever had, in 2012, I ran a national super PAC. I was the national campaign manager for the Credo operation. We worked in 10 congressional districts, taking down the Tea Party 10. You know, 10 of the most extreme conservative members of Congress who came in the 2010 wave. And my job every day for a year was to spend somebody else's money hiring all of my friends to talk in their districts about, I can't do it. Your broadcast. All right.
No, go ahead.
I'll start over.
No, go ahead.
The best job I ever had, running a super PAC that was doing independent expenditure programs, against Republican members of Congress who were, you know, the Tea Party extremists from the 2010 wave. I got to spend a year, I woke up every day and got to spend somebody else's money hiring my friends to attack the most odious members of Congress and to tell their friends and neighbors about their racist record, about their extremist record, about their anti-environmental records, about their anti-woman records, and it was thoroughly satisfying. Right, and
at least you're honest about it.
We won a bunch of elections,
right?
Because when volunteers, members of the community, went door to door and said, "You know what, Joe Walsh, we'll do the one here in Chicago."
A friend of mine.
Interesting.
Joe and I have become friends over the last year and a half or two.
So we were part of the program that helped defeat him and elect Tammy Duckworth. We would go door to door and say, "You know, your members of Congress is a deadbeat dad."
I remember, and Joe and I have had that conversation.
And people responded to it. Volunteers like to do the work. To be able to say, here's the real issue. Here's why this person is not fit for service. And it felt really good and really honest. So we make attack ads every year, every cycle. I think we do it really well. Campaigns and Elections thinks that we make great negative ads. We've won awards for them.
But you've heard it too, though. You know, people want... We want positivity,
sure.
But we devolve into the negative.
No, we do what works.
Right.
Our obligation to our clients is to be efficient and effective. And negative is often efficient.
And what does that say about us as voters? Because, look, we all, you know, I say it too. Look, I want someone who's going to make lives better. I want someone who's got a vision for the future that's going to, you know, have an agenda that's going to help working class people put their kids through college, get good wage jobs, do all this high-minded stuff. Maybe that's just the liberal in me, but we always devolve into the Joe Walsh, you know, the deadbeat dad frame, because I did it too. I'll be honest. Now, Joe and I don't agree on any policy. There is no policy that we have found common ground on yet.
That makes me feel better, Rick. But when you said Joe Walsh is a friend of mine, like I suddenly, like, whoa.
No, Joe and I have come to the reality of we're in a moment right now where democracy is under attack, and we both believe in democracy. So we have locked arms as brothers to say, look, we're going to save democracy. We pine for the days when we can fight over policy. We're not in that moment right now, Mudcat.
Yeah. At the end of that Tea Party campaign, people stopped using Tea Party. But
now they're using Moms for Liberty.
They did not become. I thought at the end of that campaign that we had sort of put the genie back in the bottle, that we had created an element of accountability for extremism, but that's not what happened. It morphed and it has mutated into something that is bad for democracy and civil society.
No, I'm right there with you. So last line of questioning I've got for you. In doing what you do, is there a way to move us in a better direction? Because, you know, look, I mean, at the end of the day, I go back to the negatives. Are we making things better? Or are we making things worse? Where do you see things going? Gotcha.
I am a romantic, man. I believe in people. I believe in campaigns. You know, Neil Gaiman does this, did a graduation speech in which he said, the answer to every problem that you will find in your life is to make more art. When you don't understand yourself, when you don't know what to do, write, paint, draw, find the things that show up in your work and push them forward. I have very adapted that, and I believe that the answer to every problem in our society is more campaigns. Let's have the conversation. If we want to talk about the importance of addressing climate change, let's have the fight. Right, you make your argument, I'll make mine, people will decide, we will move forward as a collective. I believe that people have good hearts and that there is a wisdom in crowds. If we can just talk to people and have a fair fight, we will get somewhere. Where this goes wrong, the hole in my logic is... The people who believe in the big lie, the election deniers, the people who don't care if the will of the people is reflected, they want to be right, they want to win, they want to be in power. And they are willing to sacrifice truth and logic and the important part of being an American, the idea that we all matter, that everybody who you can see, everybody who has a human form has as rich an inner life and as an important inner life as you do, that we are together and we share humanity. The people who are willing to deny that in the surface of power are destroying our country. And those are the folks we want to get up and fight. So if you are trying to save democracy, trying to preserve an idea from people who think that power is more important than people, go to CorsairCampaigns.com, click the contact button. We will call you back. We will help you solve your problem.
There you go. Mudcat, I appreciate you taking time for us. Matthew Mudcat Arnold, he's a managing partner there at Corsair Campaign. As he said, CorsairCampaigns.org, right?
.com.
We'll get links out on social media. Matthew, I appreciate the time. Good stuff. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1898. That was the day that the United States Armed Forces invaded Puerto Rico. The invasion was part of the Spanish-American War. In 1898, the U.S. State Department noted, quote, "It seems to be conceded that every year we shall be confronted with an increasing surplus of manufactured goods for sale in foreign markets if American operatives and artisans are to be kept employed year-round." Many business leaders in the U.S. clamored for market expansion. At the time, Spain was still a colonial presence in the Caribbean and Pacific. When a revolution in Cuba sought to drive out the Spanish, in the United States, the drumbeats for war began to boom. Many saw this as an opportunity to expand the U.S. sphere of influence, although some labor leaders warned against war. One official from the Longshoremen's Union warned working people, quote, "If there is a war, you will furnish the corpses and the taxes, and others will get the glory." But soon labor leaders, including the president of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers, got swept up in the war fever. In just a few months, the U.S. ousted the Spanish and became the colonial power in not only Puerto Rico, but also Guam and the Philippines, as well as Hawaii. This gave the United States footholds in the Caribbean and the Pacific. The small island of Puerto Rico remains a U.S. territory to this present day. Since the U.S. invasion, there have been movements for both Puerto Rican independence and also for full U.S. statehood. Today, the Puerto Rican people face a severe economic crisis, towering debt, and an unemployment rate more than double that of the United States. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, listening to Mudcat there, it makes me think, man, politics have gotten so complicated. You know, I know things have been complicated in the past, but when you start talking about all of the ways that they try and get our attention, all of the algorithms and all of the social media and all of the focus group testing and all of that stuff is, it's antithetical to what I would love to see, which is just good old-fashioned retail politics, face-to-face kind of stuff. I know we live in the 21st century, and you're sounding like a curmudgeon, Rick. But this is one of those things where, participatory democracy works, I think, best when you're all in a room together hammering things out. Because as I've said, I think social media has turned us all into the worst versions of ourselves. If you read some of the stuff that gets sent my way, it's rather quite vile in a lot of, with people who disagree. I've had people who go, when we're face to face, go, "I expected something much different. We disagree, and we're probably never going to agree. But I expected something different because look, I want to have these conversations. I want to get the best we can possibly get for working people." Now understand, and this is one of those things, and I'll talk about this again later, I'm sure. But there are people who don't want better outcomes. The status quo is working for them. They figured out how to make their niche, and they're doing okay. And for them, yeah, that works. But for the rest of us, it's a constant struggle. And this is where I go back to where I started today. You know, look, I'm always looking at how do we get better outcomes for working people. Look, the rich people are going to be fine. They'll figure it out. It's the rest of us. How do we make sure that we're doing better? And I got to tell you, I listened to Mudcat and I'm going, you know, it's amazing the things that they can do. And finally, you know, Democrats and some on the left are actually thinking about this stuff because the right has been kicking your behind for so long. But I just, you know, I guess it's just the old me going, I prefer to be in a room just yelling at each other. That's better, I think. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1944. That was the day Local 212 UAW workers at Briggs returned to work. Briggs was directly involved in war production. 3,000 workers on two shifts made ball turrets for heavy bombers. Workers on both shifts walked off the job when management at the outer drive plant carried out a series of transfers and layoffs while expecting the same level of production. It had been the second walkout in a week. Management set a precedent of refusing to settle grievances of any kind. They routinely snubbed the union, insisting that they take any and all grievances to the War Labor Board. Local 212 president Jess Ferraza noted that it would take anywhere from 12 to 18 months to get a grievance processed. Workers were fed up with waiting. He added, quote, "It was like a fireman with a water bucket running around trying to put fires out. Management never cooperated. If the grievance were a justifiable one, they would not settle it. They would tell you to get the workers back to work." The strike came on the heels of a contentious state CIO convention earlier in the month. There, delegates debated the merits of the no-strike pledge. Local 212 delegates were among a full third of the total delegates who made known their opposition to the pledge. Ferraza argued that, quote, "The no-strike pledge has tied labor's hands, and as long as our hands are tied, the corporations will continue their attacks on labor." Briggs workers agreed to return to their jobs on the promise of direct settlement of grievances. They also geared up for the national CIO convention, intent on overturning the wartime no-strike pledge. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Do mass protests matter anymore? Even when large numbers turn out with a high level of outrage directed at abusive corporate or governmental elites, the powers that be usually just hunker down and wait for the fury to pass. But the one form of protest that actually gets to even the most aloof elite is cultural caricature. In recent decades, the creative deployment of giant puppets, satirical songs, pop-up parodies, and other forms of social mockery has pierced the ego shields of haughty corporate chieftains and puffed-up politicos. They ignore angry speeches, but public ridicule stings them personally, energizing the larger community. Consider how common household utensils can rally the people's discontent, rattle the establishment, and deliver a message of revolutionary protest. In recent years, mass rebellions armed with nothing but kitchenware have noisily made their points in such disparate places as Chile and Iceland. And today, the people of France are bedeviling their country's aristocratic wannabe, President Emmanuel Macron, with a ceaseless mass clanging of skillets, saucepans, spoons, and other plebeian cookware brought from their French kitchens into the streets of every region. They are protesting the president's imperious decision to undercut their pensions, as well as his tone-deaf refusal even to hear their complaints. So their voice has become the incessant banging of pots. Now, Macron can't go anywhere without being greeted and often drowned out by the cacophony of casserolade, the saucepan movement. The protest is driving Macron crazy, which seems to be a very short ride for him. Clearly irritated by the commoner's cleverness, his government is now using anti-terrorism laws to ban, quote, the use of portable sound devices in protests. This is Jim Hightower saying, the crazier he gets about pots and pans, the louder people laugh at their leader.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
ultimately what we want out of these kind of get-togethers is, you know, people who are going to be active, engaged, going back to their communities, and as I've been saying, fire-breathing do-gooders, going back and moving the country forward. But it still comes back to politics. It goes back to what my eighth grade government teacher says. Government decides who gets what. And if we do not compete in this space, are you surprised that we don't get what we need? Healthcare, education, good jobs, infrastructure, safe neighbor, all that, whatever it is, it's because I don't think we've done enough. And that's why when I come to these events, candidates are the ones I want to talk to. And that's why I'm sitting here with Sean Frame. He's a Democratic candidate for California's Assembly in the 6th District. He's also a labor leader, small business owner, educator, whole bunch of stuff. And that's why I'm happy to sit down with him. Sean, thanks for taking time for us.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
So what brings you to the Windy City from way out west?
Well, you know, look, I came here initially before I knew I was running for the Assembly. So I have a pack called the Six Pack, and I came here. Basically, our pack raises money for school board candidates who are pushing back against right-wing extremism. So,
boy, do we need that.
Yeah, so that was why I came here. We're actually doing a panel here. In the time between when we decided to do the panel and set all this up, my member of the Assembly decided he was going to run for mayor, and now we have an open seat right there in Sacramento. The state capital is actually in my district, and I thought, this is the time. This is what I've been building for the last several years as an organizer, as a person who is really deeply involved in labor. It's time to bring the people of the Capital Region into the Capitol building, and that's why I'm running.
It's time to get working people into the halls of power. At the end of the day, we've had too many millionaires or too many millionaires' puppets being in these places. And look, education is right now the hill that what the working class has to die on, because there is an all-out frontal assault on public education.
Absolutely. In California, our Constitution says 40% of our budget should go toward education. That's supposed to be the floor. It's de facto become the ceiling, which means chronically our schools are underfunded. California, when I was in school, and I won't say how many years ago, but quite a long time ago, we were in the top 5 in terms of per pupil funding. We're now in the bottom quartile. We were as low as 47th at one point. And that's just because our legislature doesn't prioritize taking the funds that they get and moving them into the school system. It's just that simple.
Yeah, and how much of that is the Reagan legacy? I mean, you know, to be honest, you go back to, and that's a long time ago since Reagan was governor of California, but the damage he did, especially to higher ed, as I understand it. Look, I've never lived in California, but I've heard the stories, and I know people who said, look, this guy, you know, sold out and destroyed higher education, and that has trickled down to, you know, K-12. How much of it is that legacy being moved forward and just new and innovative ways of destroying the working class?
Yeah, so it started there, right? UCs and Cal States used to be almost free, and it's one of the best, if not the best, university system, public university system in the country. That started with Reagan. So that's obviously one part of the legacy. Another part is what we call Prop 13. The people in California will know Prop 13. It was passed ostensibly to help seniors not get taxed out of their homes, which is a reasonable social goal. But the actual intent was to make sure that corporations would never have their property taxes reassessed. So corporations in California like Chevron, Disney, corporations that can clearly pay their fair share, are paying their taxes at 1975 rates. They never get reassessed. So we have to get a split roll system that removes those corporations from that loophole and gets them back to paying taxes, which go to our education system.
So hold on here. You know, a lot of that came back through that Reagan legacy, I believe. You know, Democrats have controlled California for years now. How come that hasn't been pushed back at? Look, I don't want to kick Granny out of her home. No one does. But when you're saying Chevron, you know, these multinational billion-dollar corporations are benefiting from this, this is policy run amok.
It absolutely is. And look, here's the reality, and you know it's true. You know, if you're running and saying, hey, I want to raise taxes forever, that's just been a toxic platform, right?
Yeah.
But the bottom line is we know we have to find the money for this somewhere. And the obvious place is to have corporations who have earned billions and billions and billions of dollars in profits by being in California start giving back to the system that gave them the opportunity to do that.
And that's got to be a movement across the country. You know, I talk about this all the time. You know, when someone says we need to raise taxes, my first question is, on who and for what?
Absolutely. And we don't ask that question anymore. We've been trained as, like, Pavlovian dogs, that anytime the taxes, we foam at the mouth and get all worked up, when the reality is I go back to my grandparents. And my grandparents came back from World War II fighting fascism overseas. They went to the shop floor, they unionized, and they taxed the living daylights out of the wealth class back then. Top marginal tax rate, 92%. Corporations were paying 56% during the good socialist Dwight David Eisenhower's era. I mean, think about Ike as a socialist, because that's how he would be painted today with those tax rates. But you know what they did? They built a massive infrastructure. They funded education, and we had our wars, but we paid for them. There was no, hey, we're going to go blow things up. Here's the credit card.
That's exactly right. And look, I'm a product of California public schools. I went to CSU for both undergrad and graduate school. I graduated with no debt, and it was easy to do. And that should be the opportunity for everybody.
Now, you are showing your age. No, because that's the sad reality. And this is where, you know, a lot of people are upset about, you know, student loan forgiveness. And then the president saying, hey, this is what we should be doing. And look, I may not go, you know, total forgiveness, but there's got to be a way. We unburden a couple of generations now with the debt we've saddled them with. But telling that story is important, because you were able to work through school and not come out with a mortgage on your back before you got your first job.
Absolutely. And look, we should be also thinking about trade school. We have a huge lack of people in the trades.
Yeah.
You know, ask any union worker and they'll
tell
you
that. No,
we've
had them on the show. Look, they're dying for apprentices. And those jobs that you get out of the apprenticeship, those are $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 jobs. Those are good wage jobs.
That's the foundation of America is those middle-class jobs, and they are there for the taking. We just have to support people to get to that point where they can go to it. I mean, I think it's just as important for somebody to get into an apprenticeship program, to use our community college system as the place that people can go and not only be a springboard to a four-year education, but be a springboard to a trade. And that community college system is still one of the greatest systems in the country and is incredibly inexpensive. It ought to be free. Nobody should pay for that.
I'm right there with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Sean Frame. Sean is a Democrat running for the 6th District, the California Assembly. You want to check out his website, seanframe.com. If you like what he hears, maybe you like what he says, maybe you throw him a couple of bucks to help out on the campaign, because these are expensive. Now, you know, your platform, you're running for CalCare, green jobs, public schools. That's a very progressive platform. How's that selling in California?
It's selling great. Look, this is a deep blue district. There is no way that it should be represented by anybody other than a progressive candidate like myself, somebody who supports the working class. And, you know, to give you an example, I mean, I don't just say this. I'm in my union. I'm on the negotiating team. And right now we're literally at the table with our employer, the Sacramento County Office of Education, trying to get real wages for folks. A good portion of the people I work for in an education space in my union are working for wages that are below the poverty line, that make them housing insecure. One of my coworkers doesn't run her air conditioning between the hours of 4 and 8 because that's those peak charge hours. She can't afford it. Her rent has gone up 27% wow. in the last 3 years, and her wages have gone up 7%.
And, you know, the sad reality is that's the story for, you know, not just your members, but working people across the country. And, you know, when the inflation, you know, scare is going on, people are like, you know, we can't make ends meet. We don't talk about the solutions. Everybody is like, well, this is Biden inflation. Okay, how do we fix this? You know, what's the way forward? The way forward is going to the bargaining table, getting better wages. Because, you know, back when my grandparents in the 70s were going through this, my grandfather in 1975 got 3 raises because of the union's automatic cost of living adjustments. If we had workers in unions at the same rate that my grandparents were, this wouldn't be as big of a problem, would it?
That's right. Yeah, it's absolutely true. And, you know, organizing has really taken off in the last 2-3 years. And, you know, finally, and actually, not just organizing, but actual, you know, labor action has taken off. I heard an interview with Boots Riley the other day, and he was saying that, you know, there's been, I think, 2,900 strikes in the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Why? Because people have recognized that sometimes you can't get what you need at the table and you got to go fight.
Yep.
I tell my members all the time, they get upset. They're like, we got to go strike. I go, look, are you ready to, how long can you live without a wage? You know?
And look, you know, since you brought that up, I go back and I've been a Teamster for over 30 years. And I remember one of the first days on the job, an old timer came by, put his arm around me, said, kid, we're going to make a Teamster out of you. And one of the first bits of advice he said is, look, before you get used to spending this big money, because it's a lot more than you were making when you came here, 6 months of bills in a sock, in a tin can, in a bank account if you have to, but you have 6 months ready because you may have to walk across that threshold to protect what we've fought for. And that was the advice that I took as a young man. It's what I pass along to people. If you have that kind of security to go to last one day longer, you're going to do okay, I think.
That's exactly right. And it starts with being paid enough that you have some to sock away.
Yeah.
You know, that's the fundamental problem we have. When I started organizing at my union, I would say, well, hey, we're going to go after work. We're going to go grab a beer. We'll talk about some stuff.
And I got another job.
Exactly right. That's exactly what I heard.
Because here's where we are, and we talk about this all the time on the show. You know, my grandparents' generation, one income, could support a family. And well, you know, you could buy a house, you could buy a car, you send the kids to college, you took vacations, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, the last, you know, 40 years, it's been you need two. Mom and dad have to go into the workforce. Sadly, Sean, where we are in this moment, I believe we're going to 3-4 incomes because no longer can two even survive, which is why you see places like Iowa passing child labor laws, sending kids back into the slaughterhouses.
That when I heard that, I was just like, I cannot believe this is where we've arrived.
Yeah.
That is beyond the pale. That child labor that we fought to get rid of long ago is back.
We're making the Lochner era great again.
If you're
hungry enough and desperate enough to work for poverty wages and deplorable conditions, Sean, it's your right. It's your liberty. It's your freedom.
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of reading The Jungle.
Exactly.
The first time I read The Jungle. It's like...
And this is why I think we're seeing the kind of activism that we're seeing. And that's a good thing. And I think it's why we see guys like you. I think you've got a pretty good life, willing to put yourself out and get into the fishbowl and say, look, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring and take the arrows that are coming.
Well, I'll just say this. You know, my life is fine. It's pretty good. And I had a strong foundation that built that life. And I recognize that. The privilege I had was the money that the generations before me put toward that. Had that not happened. And by the way, not everybody had that opportunity, right? Guy that looks like me at that time had that opportunity. But right across town, there were schools that weren't as good as mine, and there were people who weren't able to go to that college. We need to be building this for everybody.
Right.
If America, the project, that this project that was started a couple hundred years ago, is going to continue and survive and thrive, the only way it happens is if we are investing back into the communities and building the kind of infrastructure that was there for me and for others.
So as you look at this event, and the last question I want to get into, you look at this event, you look at the organizers and the energy and all of this, you know, how do we use this to catapult people into elected positions? Because ultimately, we can have all of the nice T-shirts and all the wonderful signage. We can have cheers and chants and rallies and all of that stuff. But if it doesn't turn into people going and voting and electoral victories and putting people like you, Sean Frame, into office, well, it was fun. Didn't accomplish much.
Yeah, it's really building a movement. I'm a movement candidate. So, you know, the way I think about my campaign is not just my campaign to get me there. It's about who am I bringing along with me. Right. And that's what a conference like this does. It allows you to meet people that you can bring along with you. So I always think about the people who are going to be there with me. It's why I started the PAC, too. So I started a PAC to raise small dollar money for candidates, because that is the hardest thing to do in the world. We want our candidates to be corporate free. We don't want them to be owned by somebody when they get there.
Yeah, we want them owned by us.
That's right. They should be owned by us. What a concept.
Yeah.
Last cycle, we raised $600,000, about $14 at a time.
Wow.
No corporate money. And we did that specifically because we know how hard that is for grassroots candidates to do. So each of us can take a little piece. That was the piece I decided to take. There are amazing people at this conference who are taking another little piece and another little piece. And when you add it all up, we're building a movement, and a movement that will put people into elected positions that will get us where we need to go.
There you go. SeanFrame.com, the website, if you want to take a look at Sean's campaign, maybe throw in a little bit. Also, the six-pack, website for the six-pack?
It's thesixpack.com.
Wow, that was simple. I could have figured that out. Sean, I appreciate the time. Best of luck to you, brother.
Thank you, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Remember, check out the website, thesixpack.com. Also, seanframe.com. Back after this, you're listening to The Rick Smith Show here from Netroots Nation in Chicago.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1832. That was the day of the first recorded railroad accident in U.S. history. It took place near Quincy, Massachusetts. Four people were thrown off a vacant car on the Granite Railway. They had been traveling to see how the train carried heavy loads. When a cable on a vacant car snapped on the return trip, it sent them over a 34-foot cliff. One of them died. The rest were injured. Why is this a labor history event? Safety. Both worker and passenger safety is a concern for railroads. As recently as 2012, members of the Railroad Workers United met in Chicago to discuss ways to strengthen their organization. One of the major issues they discussed was worker safety. One safety concern is single employee crews, where just one person is responsible for an entire train. A few years prior to this meeting, the Railroad Workers United called on its members to wear black shirts on the Friday before Father's Day to commemorate workers killed on the job. Unions throughout the railroad industry followed and adopted similar actions. In April of 2015, Alaska Congressional Representative Don Young introduced the Safe Freight Act. The bill prohibits the operation of a freight train or light locomotive engine used in the movement of freight unless it has a crew of at least two individuals. One must be certified by the Federal Rail Administration as a locomotive operator and the other as a train conductor. From railroads' beginnings in this country in 1830, safety has always been an issue. Thanks to various railroad unions that have existed from the mid-1800s, workers have been able to push for safer working conditions. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Got an email from several people talking about healthcare, and in talking with Laura Packard a little earlier, this is one of those amazing moments that we're in. And interestingly enough, this is one of those moments that's kind of ironic, where you have some conversations with people about that they how much they hate the Affordable Care Act, but yet they use every portion of it. Interesting. One person said that their health insurance company allows them to keep their kids on their health care until they're 26. This was remarkable to me. This is one of these moments where my mind went to, okay, we're finally starting to normalize what the ACA did and internalize, where people are going to go, hey, I demand this. This is... Now, I don't care why people think it's there, but it was ironic to me in that this person was telling me how much, they believe in Trump and the free market and all this stuff, and used as an example. And this was, again, it stopped me in my tracks. It was one of those things where, well, my insurance company allows me to keep my kids on my insurance till I'm 26. And I had to go, are you serious? My response to them was very simple. Are you serious? Are you trolling me? Is this a joke? And the email I got back a day later was, no, I'm not trolling you. My insurance allows that to happen. They do this. And then I was able to, send article after article and things to where you go, no, this wasn't the benevolence of an insurance company. I'm sorry. I'm someone who believes the insurance companies are evil. Sorry. They're a necessary evil. Absolutely. But they're not in the business of doing good things. They're not in the business of being benevolent. They're in the business, you guessed it, making money.
That's what they do. So, you know, I know Laura, she's a huge advocate of the Affordable Care Act, because guess what? As she said a number of times on this show, it literally saved her life, because she had one of those junk insurance plans that we saw during the Trump years, you know, rear its ugly head again, to where you're getting these shiny cards. You're getting you know, nice shiny brochures. You're getting all kind of you know, all kind of bling, but not much coverage. Now, the weird thing, and I was thinking about this as I was talking to Laura, in my mind is going, you know, with some of these, you know, these religious groups that are doing this crowdsource funding. And look, that's great. You know, if it works for you, you know, on little things, I'm not against that. I'm not against people coming together and figuring out how to take care of their communities. All for it. I think it's a great thing. Wish more people would do it. But here's the problem. That again, is out of the goodwill of others. That's the benevolence. I don't want my health, I don't want my kids' health to be predicated on the benevolence of others. You know, there are certain things you go, these are absolutes. Healthcare being one of them, the ability to get care being one of them. And I was thinking about this because, you know, the idea, and I've seen these shiny cards and, you know, look how wonderful this gives you. It gives you a sense of, you know, some security. You know, it's like in the movie, The Tommy Boy, where the guy goes, well, you know, why don't you have a guarantee on the box? He goes, well, I can put a guarantee on the box, but, you know, all you'd be guaranteed is it's a guaranteed piece of garbage. And that's kind of where my mind is with some of these junk insurance plans. Now, I have health insurance through my union. The card is ugly. The card hasn't even held up. It is bad. The card is not something that you would sell. If you were looking at the card, you'd go, you know, that's pathetic. A child did it. But here's the thing. I know with that number that they've assigned me that I've got the best health insurance that is available in this country. I can say that without breaking a straight face. When I had my hip replaced a number of years ago, it literally cost me $120 out of pocket, front to back, start to finish, all of it. That was the doctor, the hospital, the therapy, all of it. All of that. I want that for everyone. I want everyone to be able to go, you know what? The kid broke her arm, as mine did one time. And I'll never forget it. You know, I was, you know, being the good dad. Let's go to the park. Let's have a wonderful picnic. So I took, you know, my two kids at the time. We hadn't had the third yet. And we're at the park playing. And she's on the parallel bars. And down she went. And I knew when she fell. I knew it. Oh, not good. And she popped up. And the look on her face was, broke my heart. I knew exactly what she did. And in that moment, the only thing, and this is any parent, at least I hope this is every parent, the only thing I thought is, where's the nearest hospital? Where's the nearest help? How do I get her the care she needs right now to stop the pain? How do I take the pain away? How do I make this better? Not, oh my God, this is gonna break us. Oh my God, how can I afford the copay? How am I gonna afford the deductible? Because back then, and it's got to be 15 years ago, her arm, when she broke it, because it broke it at a plate and they had to do some surgery, it was like $18,000. And you go, you know, without decent insurance, that's a struggle. That's chaos for most families. And what the ACA did is it took some of that away. Is it perfect? No, uh-uh, no, no. You're not going to hear me say anything close to that. It's barely good in my view. There are the things we should be doing much, much better. And the reason it's not better, and I'm going to tell you flat out right now, there's only one reason that it's not better. The Republican Party. It's the only reason. The only reason that it isn't much, much, much better. That it isn't worlds better. Because we could have tweaked everything that I don't agree with. We could have made it just like Medicare for everyone. But we didn't. And why? You know why. Everybody knows why. It's the Republican Party. The Republicans have stalled, delayed, tried to repeal, what, God knows, 100 times? So when this person said that, hey, the company gave me this, isn't that wonderful? There's the part of me that goes, you know what? That's success. This person is internalizing what the Affordable Care Act did and wants it and is demanding it. That's a step forward. Now, what that's going to do is that gave me an opportunity to have an opening with that person to go, you know what? We can make it even better. And I think we can. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed our last couple of interviews from Netroots. We're back in the studio tomorrow, back from our event in Washington.
You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.